what is hybrid warfare, and what distinguishes it from other forms of geostrategy? What exactly is the U.S. trying to accomplish in Syria and Ukraine, the most recent test cases for hybrid warfare? How are ethnicity, religion, and other social factors being utilized to further strategic aims? What regions of the world are likely to be the next sites of hybrid warfare? What role do massive refugee flows play in furthering or frustrating the U.S. imperial agenda? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we take a look at a unique new form of military strategy which has come to the fore in the Obama era at a time when military tensions between the U.S. and Russia continue to grow. It's called hybrid warfare, and our guest for the entire hour is an American commentator based in Moscow who authored a 2015 book on the subject. On this week's program, Hybrid Warfare and U.S. Geostrategy, a conversation with Andrew Kurbko. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 14th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The CETA agreement is a backdoor initiative which was developed in close coordination with the TTIP. Its adoption would trigger the de facto, rather than de jure, adoption of the broader TTIP agreement, leading to the eventual integration of the trading structures of the North American Union and the European Union. It would create a fait accompli, which would contribute to furthering the TTIP negotiations, most probably under a different label. It is a corporate takeover in both the EU and North America. It will serve to destroy and undermine the economy at the local level, destroy the family farm, precipitate small and medium-sized enterprises into bankruptcy, undermine social programs, etc. It is important that people in the U.S., Canada, and the European Union across the land firmly oppose the signing and ratification of the Canada and European Union, EU, Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA. That comes from the article, Towards NAFTA-EU Economic Integration, Backdoor Canada-EU Trade Agreement, CETA, Sets the Stage, by Michelle Chosadovsky, reposted October 13th. The former governor of the Bank of England, Lord King, sees a post-Brexit environment in terms of a wonderland of prospects, again ones which feature the exploits of a lower pound economy suitably placed to wage economic assault. Naturally, many of these assumptions, the May Brigade is the only one in full employment in Britain these days, is based on the UK getting bullish in its supply of products, a point that gets increasingly complicated in the event of being prized out of chains in the European Union. Those priding British sovereignty have simply assumed that Britons will be cleverer and more resilient in that regard. They will find magical markets unhindered by the sluggishness of the Eurozone. Again, the battle between marketplace, with the mammon of prosperity paraded before Britain, and the virtues of reforming a system that is not only creaking, but in some cases collapsing, continues to play out. That comes from the article, Brexit and the Despotism of the British Pound Sterling, by Dr. Benoit Campmark, posted October 12th. In one of the noblest speeches ever delivered at the United Nations during this century, Venezuelan Ambassador Ramirez, in words of brilliance, exposed the enormity of hypocrisy for which the ambassadors demonizing Russia are guilty, listing the colonialist aggressions and current war crimes throughout the Middle East and throughout the world for which the UK and the US have never been held to account. Ambassador Ramirez demonstrated that the Russian veto prevented the UN Security Council from endorsing the obliteration of Syria in the same Machiavellian way in which UN Security Council Resolution 678 on Iraq and 1973 on Libya unleashed the pulverizing bombing campaigns which turned the previously functioning and progressive governments of Iraq and Libya into current failed states incubating and rampantly spreading terrorism. The virulent beating of the war drums at the UN Security Council suggests a proxy war against Russia and predictions of Islamic terrorist attacks against Russian cities raise the terrifying prospect of another stealthy campaign to destabilize Russia, turning that sovereign country into a docile pawn of Western oligarchic interests. It would be prudent to recall that Russia is a nuclear power, and hubris doomed Napoleon and Hitler. Unfortunately, this time, hubris may also doom all humanity. That comes from the article, Beating the Drums of War at the UN Security Council. Russia vetoes resolution to implement Syria no-fly zone by Carla Stay, posted October 12th. The text of S-2040 refers broadly to sponsors of terrorism. Potentially, it constitutes a legal mechanism as well as a foreign policy instrument which could be used against countries on Washington's hate list, including Russia, China, Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, etc. Conversely, it could also be used by U.S. citizens to sue some of America's staunchest allies on terrorism charges, including Israel, UK, France, Turkey, as well as Saudi Arabia. Another issue which the media seems to have carefully neglected is that the legislation is not limited to state entities and foreign governments. The bill allows U.S. citizens to sue both foreign governments as well as foreign organizations, loosely defined, allegedly involved in acts of terrorism on U.S. soil. That comes from the article, Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, JASTA. U.S. citizens can now sue foreign governments. By Professor Michel Chostadovsky, posted October 13th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Political observers around the world are familiar with the concept of America's aggressive military tendencies going back decades. Methods of overthrowing inconvenient governments and frustrating whole nations and regions desiring to pursue an independent course has taken on a more sophisticated form, particularly during the presidency of Barack Obama. There's virtually no exposure of this phenomenon in the mainstream media. Indeed, media has been a significant component of this new form of imperialism. We're talking about hybrid warfare, and joining us to discuss the concept and take us through the examples that are manifesting themselves today, we're joined by Andrew Korybko. Andrew Korybko is an American political commentator currently working with the Sputnik news agency. He's also written for Oriental Review and Katahan, among other online journals. Much of his work focuses on the tactics of regime change, color revolutions, and unconventional warfare used across the world. His book, Hybrid Wars, The Indirect Adaptive Approach to Regime Change, extensively analyzes the situations in Syria and Ukraine and claims to prove that they represent a new model of strategic warfare being waged by the United States. Andrew Korybko currently studies at the Moscow State University of International Relations and is a member of the Expert Council for the Institute of Strategic Studies and Predictions at the People's Friendship University of Russia. Andrew Korybko, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
What exactly differentiates hybrid warfare from the other sorts of covert CIA operations that we've heard about in the past?
Okay, the way that I see it is we need to look at hybrid war as it is the epitome of all that came before it, in the sense that right now we're living in a very rapidly accelerating globalized world. Everything is moving so fast. particularly as it relates to information and the transfer of people, goods, services, whatnot. Okay, everything's moving so fast. In this type of environment where all borders are permeable to a certain extent or another, if not physically, then definitely informationally and through some other types of asymmetric measures, we see that those methods of the past, primarily CIA-driven coups, be they military coups, be they people power revolution, like a color revolution, so to speak, or even just be it a terrorist war, we see that they're kind of coming together and things are moving so fast where we see a very interesting interplay where, you know, I've identified this pattern, Michael, where it seems as though, to me, the way I look at hybrid warfare, I see it as beginning with a color revolution that is meant to achieve a couple things. It could either be to enact a regime tweaking, which I define as getting political concessions from the targeted government, regime change, which we're all familiar with, and regime reboot, which in this case means to fundamentally rewrite the rules of the game. In some cases, change the constitution, federalize the unitary state, what have you. Now, when that color revolution fails or doesn't result in the expected dividend, it happens to almost organically transition into an unconventional war or a terrorist war, like we saw in Syria. The failed Arab Spring color revolution gave way to Daesh and terrorists over the place. And I see that, you know, if we look at these transnational connective infrastructure projects, like when you quoted my law of hybrid warfare, we can actually start to map those areas that can actually be vulnerable to manufactured identity conflict. Most of these conflicts are already present. There already are some indicators, some tensions. Some of these things are naturally occurring to an extent, but the U.S. promotes the conditions for conflict amongst these different identities, using NGOs, using information warfare, using a variety of things, sometimes even scenarios, like in the case of Syria, which is the epitome example of what's happening nowadays. Even NGOs that turn into terrorists, like the White Helmets. I mean, Vanessa Bealey has done amazing work on that. So has Ava and Patrick Henningsen. They've done great work on that. But this is how I look at it, basically, Mark. Everything kind of coming together, intermingling according to this broad pattern that I've identified, and just adapting to the local circumstances, the local conflict problems and scenarios that we have there, and just kind of, you know, it's almost like a self-perpetuating process. Someone had once called it auto-synchronization. I thought that was a very accurate way to put it. And that's what we have here. That's what we have here. That's why it's different than other forms of coups and things, because this is pre-planned. This usually involves a large network of foreign state-based conspirators, be it in Ukraine, you had Paul in Syria. I mean, we know all the countries involved, the United States, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. We can't forget this entity that people call Israel. It's also very heavily involved.
25 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was, that one pole of this bipolar world. And so we've seen a lot of actions since then, which seem to be concerned with preventing the reestablishment of an alternative to the U.S. Dominant superpower. We're living in effectively a unipolar world, and so much of this, where the hybrid war phenomenon somehow intersects with this reality of a dominant superpower trying to maintain its dominance. I mean, has that not added to a specific feature or flavor to this strategy?
100%. That sets the whole background of strategic context for hybrid warfare. And actually, it's pretty funny that you brought this up, Michael, because this is exactly what I was writing about today when I was doing some work on my PhD. I was actually looking at 1990s American foreign policy and how this kind of paved the way for what we have today with regime change technology. So to answer the question, in 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, then Secretary of Defense, came out with what is known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine. This was a huge game changer. This came out around the beginning of 1992 or so. It was important because it was the first main defense promulgation that came out after the end of bipolarity, basically in the opening days of the unipolar world. And it was very clear in saying that the United States' objective is to make sure that no rival any region can ever rear their head, or the U.S. will preemptively act to stop them. Now, in practice, what that means is to prevent the strategic convergence of Russia, China, and Iran. However, what we see, though, is we see that with this Wolfowitz doctrine, one of the other, if we're going to talk about a theoretical aspect behind it, is this idea of perpetuating the hegemonic stability theory, which is an idea in international relations literature that says that the only way to have peace across the world is to have one country rule over the rest. Very, very imperial. It is the epitome of postmodern imperialism. But this is what the neoconservative faction of the American elite believes. Now, when I talk about neoconservatives for a moment, I refer to them as being an ideological faction of the deep state. By deep state, I define this as the permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies that ensure policy continuity amidst, you know, regular regime change in the U.S. By this, I mean elections. Theoretically, though, it's a regime change, right? Now, how this relates to what we have today with hybrid war and everything that happened in the 1990s, early 2000s, Bush, and continuing on towards with Obama is, to prevent the convergence of Russia, China, and Iran, the idea was to kind of marry the Wolfowitz doctrine with Zbigniew Brzezinski's Eurasian Balkan theorem, which very simply says that, hey, in the global transcontinental pivot space, so the so-called greater Mideast, including what we identify as the Mideast, North Africa, Horn of Africa, Central Asia, Caucasus, and even up to the Balkans, by the actual Balkans by some definition, this area is right in the middle of the tricontinental pivot space. However, it has many, many diverse identities. It has a history of internal discord, a lot of this influence from abroad. The idea that Brzezinski had, based off of his research in the 1970s, before he created the Mujahideen with Jimmy Carter, was to use the Islamic factor and to use kind of this clash of civilizations idea to just splinter the whole thing up, basically divide it all up, and through this chaos, this creative chaos, if you will, that will create enough problems to keep Eurasia divided. Now, what's interesting is, actually, talks about, you know, dividing this up and everything in the clash of civilizations. He doesn't talk about that, but at the same time, that's where Samuel Huntington came out with his idea. Why this is so important, Michael, is many people took the clash of civilizations to be a warning. The way I see it, it wasn't a warning. It was a blueprint for how the U.S. would implement the Eurasian Balkans and the Wolfowitz Doctrine in dividing and ruling the entire Eastern Hemisphere. And we see that George Bush, with the invasion of Iraq, the war on Iraq in 2003, and Afghanistan in 2001, these two states were already predetermined targets. I mean, there's existing publicly available literature from Project for a New American Century and other neoconservative outlets that pinpoint these countries as targets because of what they geostrategically represent. Yes, there was energy as a factor. On the other hand, there was also the idea of an American presence in these various strategic regions. Iraq's in the middle of the Middle East. Afghanistan is in a tri-regional pivot space. Central Asia, West Asia, otherwise known as the Middle East, and South Asia. We can return to Afghanistan later if you want to talk about the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor and what India is doing to help the United States with that. But the long story short is, using these identity conflicts that the region is already predisposed to, the United States sought to keep Russia, China, and Iran separated through this controlled chaos, if you will. But as we see, though, when you open the Pandora's box, it doesn't always go the way that you want. When the U.S. engineered the Euromaidan urban terrorist coup in Ukraine, also rural terrorism involved as well in the western reaches, taking over military facilities, police stations, so on and so forth, was barely reported except for once or twice in Newsweek magazine. But, and forget that. Who would have thought that Crimea would have reunified with Russia? Who would have thought that the chaos the U.S. unleashed in Syria would result in Russian anti-terrorist operations?
Okay, I want to just sort of move back just a little bit to some of what you're saying. We're talking a little bit about some of the antecedents of this hybrid warfare technique.
Yes.
And of course, you mentioned the name Brzezinski. And when you're talking about this idea of making use of things like ethnicity and religion and deliberately generating chaos, it's interesting to reflect on this idea of how that vision may be evolving, and how much these human dynamics, psychological dynamics, are coming into play as these strategists are putting forth their operations, their military campaigns, with a huge emphasis on the psychological development dimension.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to look at the personal psychological development, and, you know, if you want to focus on Brzezinski, I mean, we can't get away from the fact that he is an asshole from Poland. Why this is important is it means that he was, sometime throughout his life, he was exposed to the ideas of Piłsudski. Piłsudski was an interwar Polish leader. Some people herald him as the father of Poland after World War One. Many Polish patriots, they adore him. But why I'm bringing him up is because he had this innovative strategy called Prometheism. And this idea was really the main antecedent of the Eurasian Balkans and everything else, because if we accept that Brzezinski is the main innovator of this creative chaos Eurasian Balkans theorem, and we trace his heritage to around this time with Piłsudski, obviously Brzezinski is very well aware of international relations, literature, thought. He's a very proud Pole. I mean, he knows about Piłsudski. Piłsudski's idea was this, Michael. His idea was you have the Soviet Union. It is a very identity-diverse state, many religions, ethnicities, histories, all these hybrid war vulnerabilities that you read out in the introduction are present in the Soviet Union. So what Piłsudski's Poland wanted to do was exploit these by making these types of unholy alliances, for example, with Ukrainians, Georgians, trying to send out feelers to Chechens, things like this, to see how far they can go in undermining the identity unity or the patriotism of the Soviet Union. Now, they didn't succeed. Actually, everything had failed, and the idea is seen as actually being a failure by most. However, I take a radically different interpretation. I say that it was very far ahead of its time in the sense of looking at the Soviet Union's vulnerabilities that could in turn be transplanted to any other strategic identity-diverse state, as Brzezinski did. If we trace Brzezinski's published literature back, we see that in the late 1970s, I think it was 1978 or so, he came up with a construction called the Arc of Chaos. This is very important in the modern day because he basically says the entire Indian Ocean arc, because of, he focuses on the Islamic factor, but it could be many other factors as well, but we can concentrate on the Islamic factor. Because of that, it's very vulnerable to destabilization, particularly an outside state. In this case, he suspected it would be the Soviet Union. I think in this case, he was kind of mirroring what the U.S. would do in the future. He said the Soviet Union could exploit this factor to incite communist rebellions and so on and so forth. What actually had happened, though, is we see that he was already looking at weaponizing the religious factor. I mean, he was focusing on weaponizing Islam. He did this in 1979 when he openly admitted to funding and creating the Taliban with Jimmy Carter, who, ironically, for some reason or another, is identified with peace, which is such a lie for many reasons, including this one, in order to incite the Soviet anti-terrorist intervention in Afghanistan. So we kind of see how this is all coming together. Now, if you, the real antecedent, now that we're talking, I just remembered something else. We can really go back to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, where he was trying to emphasize self-determination and democracy for all these disparate identity separate groups. U.S. did not have the capability at the time to follow through on this, but it created a very dangerous precedent of the U.S. theoretically being that global cop trying to be involved in inciting worldwide revolution. Everyone makes a big deal about Lenin and communist revolution. Nobody really focuses on the danger of what Woodrow Wilson wanted to do. Communist revolution is not happening anymore. It's not being, you know, disseminated like it was during the Soviet period with the Cold War, but what the U.S. created with Woodrow Wilson and enunciated during that time at the end of World War One, we still feel the effects today, and people are still getting killed every day over this ideology.
You know, now, Syria, the strategic importance there from the standpoint of U.S. war planners, is it strictly a pipeline, or what would you say is the main thrust of the U.S. motivation for trying to overthrow the Syrian regime?
Yeah, what it was with Syria and why the U.S. wanted to overthrow a democratically elected, legitimate Syrian government is because, yes, Syria was working on something called a friendship pipeline, which was envisioned to be a gas pipeline from Iran, Iraq to Syria, which would have led to Europe. And actually, in going forward with this perspective of friendship pipeline, President Assad had rejected a Qatar pipeline through Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and or part of Iraq. It's unclear where it would have gone through Syria, then through Turkey. Now, we also can't discount when we look at the strategic situation in the Middle East, that Syria has never signed a peace treaty with this polity of Israel, people call Israel, and this actually goes back to what Hillary Clinton was actually proven to have said. I think it was in a WikiLeaks document, I forget through which type of medium this information came out on, but that she actually said that actually this war on Syria is to protect this entity of Israel's interests. So now that relates to many things, including the Syrian government support of Palestinian liberation movements in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, but also now we see this energy geostrategic security. But now if we also look at it in a broader context and we take away the situational triggers, which undeniably played a very large role, we see that now that we're in a new silk reality, if we will, what China's trying to do with fostering global interconnectivity, primarily through mobility, then it's going to be built up to other forms of connectivity. We see that, you know, Syria, right before the verge of these Arab Spring color revolutions, Syria had promulgated a policy called the 5C strategy. This idea was that Syria wanted to become the nexus for trade connecting the Black Sea, Caspian Sea, Persian Gulf, Red Sea, and the Mediterranean. Now, we didn't really see much from the strategy because it was promulgated right around the time when this whole thing started. But we see now with China's renewed interest in Syria, now that it seems to be almost undeniable to all that the war on the country, you know, it's favoring the government, it's favoring the people, the terrorists are definitely on the run. The war, God willing, will be resolved. Who knows when, but I feel maybe in about 6 or 8 months, the fighting should be over, I hope at least. But the reason I'm bringing this up, Michael, is because Syria is located uniquely in a position where it can bring together all these routes, just like it did through the traditional Silk Road. And so we see that. Then we also have energy interest in the Mediterranean as well, and that also plays a factor. And I think that, you know, when we look at Syria's pre-existing demography, we see that the Syrian people have a very strong patriotism. These divisions that we see in society now, they're artificially created, and they're the result of traumatic, incessant warfare on the psychology of the people and also physically on their lives. The way the U.S. saw it, though, the paper reality, not the real reality, but the paper reality was, okay, there's Druze, there's Sunni, there's Shia, there's Alawite, there's Kurds. The way they saw it on paper was, hey, we can trigger a conflict, and these identities are just going to just fall apart. That wasn't actually what happened. I mean, we see some signs of it happening, particularly with the Kurds, but they were just being advantageous because they want to create what I've referred to as a second geopolitical Israel, or in other words, a country formed out of the territory of other countries and other people with Western help in order to wage war against all the neighbors and keep the situation in a climate of instability. I mean, this is the whole point of this so-called Kurdistan, but to not digress too much, that's why Syria was targeted for the energy considerations, because the security of this entity of Israel, what people call Israel, and also because the Pentagon planners, they looked at the paper reality. They thought, hey, they can snap their fingers and it'll be over with. It wasn't. The color revolution failed. They didn't expect that. When it did fail, they tried to do their backup, which was Salafist terrorism. That failed. So then they started trying to promote this identity separateness. That mostly failed. I mean, it succeeded with some Kurdish groups, not all Kurds, though. Most Kurds are very patriotic, but sometimes a couple rotten apples, they might not spoil the whole bunch, but they make the whole bunch taste sour.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. This insurgency, if you will, it seemed to begin with a legitimate grievances from within the country, but you had these larger international forces, well, U.S. And their allies just infiltrating these peaceful movements with these militarized extremists, and they essentially took it over. And I think you can find something of an analog within Ukraine, where the Maidan, there were legitimate concerns with the existing government, but you had the presence of those extremist neo-Nazis and whatnot that were getting all the support through these organizations, National Endowment for Democracy and all those other entities. There are existing grievances that just kind of get inflamed with this bolstering, this sort of shot in the arm of militarized forces on one side.
Yeah, you certainly have that, but one of the things that I wrote about in my writing is about the law of hybrid war. I think it's the second edition where I compare Ukraine and Syria. Is I do mention, though, that, yes, in Syria, I mean, there is this myth that there were these pre-existing grievances, and in theory, anyone can have a grievance about anything at any time. However, factually, Syrian Arab Republic is actually, it was one of the most developed, stable, and the most secular countries in the entire Arab world. And why that's important is because this myth of grievances. I mean, yes, I read a lot of the literature about that, what people say, and I spoke to many Syrians, including quite a few Syrians that live here in Moscow that I study with. And what I've discovered is, you know, how do I say it? Some people can sometimes have their perceptions manipulated, and there is a kind of, you can say, a general psychosis going through a region, like this whole Arab Spring, this idea, this the concept of change, everybody get together, kind of played off the whole pan-Arabism of old, kind of just playing on these ideas, but doing it in a very postmodern way. It makes people, how do I say it, even people in this situation might think twice and wonder. Now, what I'm saying by this is, this was meant to be large-scale psychological warfare on the minds of every Syrian. But not every Syrian bit. Yes, there were Syrians that did bite that bait. They started going out, protesting, banging drums, what have you. But we need to remember that what happened in Daraa with these supposedly the legend that these kids were spray painting some anti-government graffiti and were arrested, beat up, or whatever they say. Actually, we need to look at the real genesis that was later revealed, that actually around that time, terrorists were killing police officers and killing military servicemen. Government was keeping it under wraps for a bit because they didn't want to contribute to this psychosis, this outbreak of psychosis that was sweeping the region that we now call in hindsight the so-called Arab Spring. But that's what was happening, actually. I mean, there were some pretty bad people that were starting to kill police officers, killing troops, I mean, starting to attack regular people in crowds. And
sounds then you have similar
the whole information warfare level for them.
Yeah, it sounds similar to when there was the lead up to the NATO's aggression in Yugoslavia, where you're sort of reporting on the discontent with the Yugoslav government. But like, it's only one side that seems to be getting the sympathy of the wider international public, and so you have a lot of provocation of the government that's
yes,
not
being absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because with the whole provocation is that that fulfills what I've called a trigger event. Is typically in order to catalyze the masses, those that are already earlier socially preconditioned to accepting some type of regime change movement, whether they call it a democracy movement, a Salafist movement, what have you, any type of identity separateness, there typically is a trigger, even in the case of Ukraine, signing or not signing a controversial piece of legislation, the EU association agreement. Now, in Syria, you didn't have that. Actually, the provocations, the trigger events had to be entirely manufactured. Hence the information warfare and blowing out of proportion, this idea of those Daraa children and all this other stuff. And actually, that these self-perpetuating or auto-synchronous processes work is they kind of feed off of provocations to where they try to create one. So once one is created, the information warfare component blows it out of proportion, gives it that role of being a trigger event, throws emotions onto it, the way they market it, the way they present it, as a way to increase the information warfare on the targeted population, turn it up a couple notches, and get regular people so incensed because they're misled, they go out, take part in the process, maybe get beat up themselves by some of these provocateurs, but they don't realize it until afterwards. I mean, this is the whole thing. The provocations in Syria were entirely manufactured through the hybrid warfare waged against it, but in Ukraine, whereas manufactured situation was, it was working along. They were taking advantage of actual situations that were already occurring. They were already polarizing, for better or for worse. And all countries do polarizing things. You make a decision, right or wrong, yes or no, A or B. It's natural. but they chose to make this a false civilizational choice in Ukraine, hence why that EU association agreement became the trigger event. Whereas in Syria, no one could really put a finger on any trigger event because there wasn't any. There were a bunch of provocations that attempted to be a trigger event, the most famous one of which was this chemical weapons false flag hoax carried out by Turkish-supported, American-supported Qatari, Israeli, and Saudi-supported so-called rebels, actually terrorists. But that's what happened. I mean, this is a big difference here. But what we can learn from this, though, Michael, is actually provocations, they can be planned far in advance. And you see in media that typically doesn't know anything about a country reporting on it like they're experts, those people have been given a script, those people have been given talking points, and they're trying to mislead the audience, like what's happening in Ethiopia, for example, or what's always happening with Pakistan, for example. These are perfect instances.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking about media and also the existence of social media and the internet, what kind of an interaction are we seeing there? Because we kept hearing so much with regard to the so-called Arab Spring about how the Twitter and social media was getting all this information out there. That's had some kind of an accelerator effect for this whole concept of hybrid war, is it not?
Yeah, it did, absolutely. And that's what I talk about in my book, which is available on orientalreview.org. I believe you guys also had a link on Global Research a while back, too, which thank you for that as well. I was very honored that you guys had posted on the site. And I write about how social media, particularly Twitter, is used as a tactical organizational mechanism. Basically what I mean, and to simplify it, it's used to organize people, disseminate information, and get them to attack, be it swarm, which could be violent or nonviolent, or physically attack in a rough location at a split second. Basically, because it can be organized so quickly and the information disseminated to a broad group of people at the snap of a finger, it's very difficult for the government to respond to that as it's happening. Now, governments could take proactive measures in terms of street barriers, curfews, the many different things they can do, but Twitter is meant to give the insurgents, the urban insurgents, split-second change of plans and split-second flexibility with what they want to do. Facebook is very important because that's used to disseminate information. I get a lot of good information from Facebook, but Facebook can be abused. All these technologies can be abused. It can be used for good or bad. It's like a gun. It can be for a freedom fighter or for a terrorist. Depends on who's holding it and for what purposes. I mean, you have Google Maps, excellent resource. But on the other hand, if you're just sitting around with a couple of people and you're getting paid by an NGO to protest and create protest routes and where you're going to have supplies and all kinds of other devious things, if you want to take it that far, Google Maps is the best thing to ever happen to any tech, to be honest with you. But it's also one of the best things to happen to anybody. So it's all in the eye of the beholder, how you use it. We see YouTube, for example. YouTube is fantastic for propaganda dissemination. So many times I have seen so many fake or misleading videos from Syria, Ukraine, what have you. What they're doing is they show a situation decontextualized. Sometimes it's even fake.
Exactly.
We know now,
yeah.
Pentagon spent $500 million in terrorist propaganda, and it was fake. Makes you wonder how much of this is false flag propaganda. I mean, you know that. That's what's happening.
The point is,
on YouTube and they make a news article.
Yeah, the point is that you're living in this media atmosphere now where everybody's trying to one-up each other and trying to get the scoop and trying to get the latest information, but it's so hard to get proper sourcing on any of that. And how many people can even afford to take the time to do those fact checks when you've got that accelerator effect that it's, I mean, you're not just competing for the 5 o'clock news. I mean, the choice when the story is changing and you're in a dynamic, which is changing minute to minute, this becomes urgent to get this stuff out. So even if you just have a hunch, probably right, and so you just put it out there before you have a chance to really investigate. And that's a huge, it's very helpful to those forces that are looking to instigate their own malevolent ends.
Yeah, it certainly is, and actually, that's what we come to when we talk about structural preconditioning. Is right now, in the average mindset, I'd say most of the people that are in the mindset is that, hey, just like you described, I mean, it's split-second news. You have to make a decision. Are you going to promote it? Are you going to share it? Even if the news outlet decides not to, you have thousands of people on social media that can. Many people now, in some countries, the majority of people that are youth, they're getting the information on their phone from Facebook. That's where they're getting the news. So what you really need is people need to have their own interpretive framework for deciphering events. They need to have their own standards. Sometimes they need to go with their guts. But people need to literally question what's happening, and they need to sometimes step back and think. You know what I do, Michael, when I read something about a rapidly developing situation, one of the first things that I do is if I'm reading it and I feel a certain emotion that feels like it wants to compel me to do something in the back of my mind, I stop and I think. Because you know why? That emotion was implanted in my brain through those words, those images, those sounds. And that's not something natural that I would be feeling. I know that is a direct result. That is a direct result of this information warfare. So if people are reading something, and if something, this isn't all the time, and this is in general, with controversial situations, if someone feels like provoked to act, right? If they feel like this is trying to provoke the reader to act and do something that's against my values, against my morals, against my principles, well, more than likely it is. And more than likely, you're actually one of the 1% that's stopping and thinking about it and not going out in the street holding a sign one day, holding a gun the next. Next thing you know, you got bodies at your feet and a hot gun on your waist. That's how these things actually work with some of the people, and they're getting paid for, they're getting inside, or they're taking advantage of crowd mentality. All these things, this is the way these things work. And these, some of these NGO people, yes, there are innocent NGOs. There are NGOs that work with environmental, humanitarian concerns. There are some legitimate ones. But in general now, with what we see as with what we've seen happen with these so-called white helmets, which are just Al-Qaeda with the helmet, when we see Soros Foundation, which is basically CIA CIA in jeans, if you will, trying to fit in whatever country they're located in, you know, it just makes people distrust what's happening, and that's how we have to face these things. We need to distrust it. If it's foreign finance and if it's operating in your country and if it has anything to do with politics, it needs to be labeled a foreign agent or needs to be kicked out.
So taking everything that we've been discussing and, with regard to the Syria and Ukraine cases, let's, as you say, take it to a practical application and learn where we can predict the next important hybrid wars are about to strike. So where would you like to, looking at some of those other areas, what's an important flashpoint that we should be keeping our eye on right now?
Oh, there's actually two, and they're erupting simultaneously. Basically, before I say what they are, I want to remind everybody that these hybrid wars are meant to target transnational connective infrastructure projects to either disrupt, control, or influence them, using identity conflict in the targeted state, supported by lead-from-behind actors, a.k.a. American proxy allies. Well, one of the most important that's happening right now, you have the China Pakistan Economic Corridor. It is the most, it's the largest Silk Road project, at least $46 billion committed so far. So it's a staple of the whole Silk Road all across the world, being built at an astronomical pace. The whole point is to connect China to the Indian Sea to get around the Strait of Malacca. Very strategic. Why are they doing that? They couldn't go through Myanmar because the government there kind of took a couple of steps back from China. And they stopped a high-speed rail project that's supposed to go from Kunming, which is the capital of Yunnan province, to Quang Phu, which is a bordering port in Rakhine State. That's also erupting now, interestingly, because Su Ji has now gone back into possible negotiations with the Chinese for this possible railroad. Her last time in Beijing, now you just had, I think you had like 9 police officers killed yesterday in Rakhine State. We can discuss that in a second, but getting back to Pakistan, this project, CPEC, as it's colloquially called, it's huge. It is literally, it is like the it's the jugular vein of the multipolar world. It's one of the jugular veins, other than the one going between Russia and China and Kazakhstan. Now, the problem, though, is India. India, great country, wonderful civilization, amazing people, very friendly. I mean, great culture. But the problem is, country has turned towards the United States within the course of 2.5 years. Narendra Modi, who follows the Hindutva ideology, it is a Hindu supremacist ideology. Anyone can look it up. A very, very violent type of ideology. I compare it to Wahhabism, American exceptionalism, and Zionism. To be honest with you, this is how bad it is. Anyhow, he sided with the United States against China. It wasn't hard to do. I mean, he's a Hindu nationalist. He hates China for his own reasons. There have already been pre-existing border disputes between China and India. So it was an easy catch for the United States. You get this guy in power, he's basically going to do whatever. Even though he was previously on a travel ban by the U.S. and EU, they co-opted him like that in the snap of a finger. Now what's happened is India is working with Afghanistan to destabilize Pakistan. India's research and analysis wing, known as RAW, it's their version, the CIA, has been supporting certain terrorists going across the Pakistani border. At the same time, India, unprecedentedly, Modi, on the Indian Independence Day speech, 69th anniversary of independence, it was this August, he spoke about Balochistan. This is a transnational region, sub-state region, between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. The Baloch people, they don't number that much, but they're very strategically located. Why? The terminal point for CPEC ends in Pakistani Balochistan, the port of Gwadar. Well, he wants that area to be independent. He's been very, very insistent about this. It's very obvious what he wants. He wants to give political asylum and even possibly make this one Baloch independence leader guy who's living in Europe now, even make him the head of a government in exile. Basically, he wants to pull a Tibet with what, you know, India was doing with Tibet against China for decades with the United States. That's very dangerous. It's also dangerous because India has investments across the border in Iran and Chabahar port with the North-South corridor, which will connect India, Iran, Azerbaijan, Russia, and all the way to West Europe. Any type of transnational separatist conflict in Pakistani Balochistan is going to go into Iranian Balochistan. And Iran sees that. That's why Iran has recently decided to work with CPEC and possibly even invite China and Pakistan to cooperate in the Indian finance port. And, of course, we have Kashmir, which is Indian held, but for the world's largest so-called democracy, they don't want to have an independence referendum, which is very ironic. Second project, Michael, is what's happening in East Africa. China built a railroad between Djibouti to Addis Ababa, capital of Ethiopia. Djibouti is an interesting country. It has U.S., Saudi, French, even Japanese forces sitting there. China's opening its first overseas base there. Why Ethiopia is important? It has 100 million people, very identity diverse, one of the fastest growing economies in the world, still comparatively poor, though, has amazing industrialization potential. It's China's number one African ally. China needs an overseas market for its overcapacity, for its overproduction in mainland China. Why? China doesn't want to slow down their factories. You slow down factories, you increase unemployment, you increase unrest. Next thing you know, you make yourself even more vulnerable to color revolution. It's unnecessary. Might as well keep selling, basically. China also wants to lift Africans out of poverty. China sees the Chinese dream in Africa. What Africa is going through, China went through in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and is still going through to an extent. So it wants to work with Ethiopia. Same time, though, over the past 10, 11 months, there have been some protests among some of the larger pluralities of the country, the Amhara and the Oromia. The Oromia are the largest plurality in Ethiopia. What's interesting, Michael, is we talk about the media, and you mentioned that earlier, and I think I remarked on a pre-planned provocation. But you had an Ethiopian runner in the Rio Olympics, forget his name, don't even know what track event he was running in. All I know is he got a silver medal. How do I know it? It was all over CNN. Why? Across the finish line, he had his arms up as an X. Apparently, this is some sign of protest. The media went wild. Why? It was pre-planned. It was pre-planned to have this guy do a protest at the Rio Olympics to create this information warfare, to draw attention to what's happening in Ethiopia. Now these Ethiopian rioters are burning down international factories, international flour companies. You know, the Dutch flour companies are being burnt down, Turkish factories destroyed. Why? They want to step up international pressure in Ethiopia. They want to divide Ethiopia and get rid of China's plan. You get rid of the Djibouti Addis Ababa Railroad, get rid of Ethiopia, which has many problems, don't get me wrong. It's not a saintly state by any means, but it's trying. It's made a lot of progress in the past 2 decades. Then, you know, it's going to be a lot more difficult for Africans to rise up out of unipolarity and enter the multipolar world. So these two things, Ethiopia and Pakistan, that's where it's at right now, against the CPEC using India and against Djibouti, Addis Ababa Railroad using Gulf Cooperation Coalition and Council, sorry, and also using Egypt and Eritrea.
We're seeing huge refugee flows, springing out of these areas in North Africa and Syria and nearby areas. I'm wondering where these huge refugee flows figure into the hybrid war scenario.
Oh, this is very, I've written about this multiple times on Katehan, which everyone can check out. Main principle is this. Western European countries were leaning towards Russia right before the start of this immigrant crisis. However, the United States feels uncomfortable about that for many reasons. It's very obvious. I mean, if Europe started economically cooperating more with Russia and China, the U.S. would lose its unipolar influence to an extent. The best way to prevent that from happening is to insert hybrid war variables into the targeted countries. Now, it's a lot harder, to do than it might sound. I mean, how do you get Germans to want to overthrow a German government? I mean, it would have seemed kind of crazy a couple years ago, right? You look at the German disposition. They're not those type of people. Well, you see what's happening. I mean, Europe's strongest economy. People don't usually protest. Now you have over a million, civilization dissimilar, quote-unquote refugees. And I emphasize the civilizational dissimilarity, not because there's anything wrong with that. Not at all. I mean, actually, I embrace all people. I have no problem with where someone's from, what their creed is, nor what language they speak. But I'm saying this to emphasize how the average person looks at it, how the average host, population, individual looks at it. They see a bunch of people coming in that don't speak the language, don't want to work, a lot of them being very aggressive towards women especially. And they say, hey, now they're getting upset. Now you start seeing now, a couple years ago, there was no domestic tension in Germany. So now it's all over. It's in Germany, France, Austria. It's in all these countries that could have been pragmatic partners with the multipolar world to different extents. Now, it gets as simple as if any of these leaders, if they ever wanted to, let's just say, partner with Russia or partner with China, sign a free trade deal with China, for example, you can best believe, be it between the hardcore Salafists, be it between the neo-Nazis, the militant leftists, I mean, this is also a problem. Not many people have focused on there. Unfortunately, a lot of people with leftist ideology have been very, very militant throughout this immigrant crisis. You have these people rising up. You have regular citizens rising up because they're scared. They're calling the middle, regular, real refugees, real immigrants calling the middle. You have social chaos. You have the exact preconditions needed to create a situation where a government could be compelled to step down, early elections held, new U.S. public gets in. How do you create these large flows of people? Well, you destroy those countries. I mean, there wouldn't be people leaving if it wasn't for the war on Syria, the war on Libya, and the war on Yemen. We can't forget that. And we see, though, some of these people leaving, though, they're not all good guys. I mean, if we look or girls, but most of them are actually guys. We look at Syria, for example, most of the, displaced people are currently displaced. They're in, areas protected by their government, the Syrian Arab Army. They don't want to leave. I'm not saying if you leave, you're a terrorist or anything like that. But, I mean, some of the people that did leave, evidently, I mean, they obviously have Salafist dispositions. We see them. We see them cut off a hand in Syria. Next day, they're hugging a kid in, Germany or Switzerland or something like that. And then you have copycat refugees.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We only got about a minute left. But I was wondering if there's maybe some way we could kind of just try to bring the conversation to a close, maybe with some sort of maybe certain tips, hints for, whether it's countries like Russia and China or, just independent countries, like the best defense against this kind of hybrid warfare manipulation. Are there any hints at how these, what the Achilles heels of these the hybrid war planners might be?
Okay, the way I see it, these countries are always playing defense. So the game's kind of skewed in one direction from the get-go. But that being said, they need to emphasize patriotism, which is very different than nationalism. President Putin quoted a Russian philosopher sometime over the summer or around May, and he said, he's very clear about it, patriotism is love of your country, nationalism is hatred of the other. It's very important because in identity diverse states like the Russian Federation, Syrian Arab Republic, People's Republic of China, Islamic Republic of Iran, there are many different identities, people, creed, ethnicities. And people need to sit together. They need to have a unified idea, a unified reason, an integrated historical idea to want to stick together and to want to repel any of these information provocations. The more patriotic a population is, the less susceptible it is to hybrid warfare. To hybrid warfare organic infiltration, quote unquote. By that, I mean using the information, the NGOs, and so on and so forth. Next, they need to, like I mentioned earlier, if there's any type of foreign-funded non-government organization in your country, it needs to be not labeled. It needs to be branded as a foreign agent or kicked out of the country, and some need to be kicked out. Soros Foundation is illegal in the Russian Federation, and I say thank God, Michael. Next, you also have to make sure that, I mean, your borders are secure. You have to also have rapid reaction task forces because mercenaries will pull through. I mean, they're going to go across the border. You have to be able to watch out for that. And next, you need to have a very strong narrative to counter this information right away. This is where alternative media comes in and patriotic NGOs inside the targeted state. The more patriotic people are, the more people are reminded of the counter-narrative, in this case, the truth to the propaganda, the less likely they are to believe it. Then the provocateurs are going to expose themselves by being few in number. They're going to have less they're going to have less human shields surrounding them. By human shields, I mean interested folks that get caught up in this protest, they think it's revolution, they think it's fun and games, they go around for the ride, someone gets shot in the head by a sniper, this type of stuff, okay? Less likely that's going to happen. So you're able to isolate the problem, you're able to target it, and target it physically, you target on the information front, then you push back. You push back by exposing it. You expose what's happening, you expose the networks, and you expose the future scenarios. When people are positively preconditioned into what can happen if they go along with the stuff, they're going to be less likely to do it because they see what's going to happen. And the best way to precondition someone is with facts. Show them what happened to Syrian Arab Republic with the hybrid war in that country. Show them what happened to Libya, Iraq. Show them what's happening in the Balkans. Show them that stuff. Make them aware and remind them, because some people, they don't have a they don't have long memories. They need to be reminded. All you got to do is turn on a TV and you're reminded.
Intellectual inoculation. I could go down with that. I want to thank you very much, Andrew Korobko. I'm sorry we've got to call it quits for now, but I really enjoyed this conversation, however troubling some of the subject matter could be. But thanks again for joining us on this Global Research News Hour.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you to the audience for tuning in.
Andrew Korobko is an American political commentator based in Moscow and currently reporting for Sputnik News Agency. He's the author of the 2015 book Hybrid Wars, The Indirect Adaptive Approach to Regime Change, and his work frequently appears on the Global Research website, among other online journals. Just one final note before we close the show. The Honorable Paul Hellyer, book author, activist, and cabinet minister under three Liberal prime ministers, will be speaking in cities in Western Canada over the next few weeks. He's promoting a new social contract with the people that calls for the use of the Bank of Canada to finance critical and needed national initiatives. On October 20th, Mr. Hellyer will speak in Winnipeg at the University of Winnipeg in Eckhart-Gramatay Hall on the third floor of Centennial Hall at 7 p.m. Then in Calgary, on Monday, October 24th at 6 p.m., he speaks at the John Dutton Theatre Library at 616 McLeod Trail Southeast. Mr. Hellyer speaks in Edmonton on Wednesday, October 26th at 7 p.m. at Central Lions Recreation at 11113 113th Street. He speaks in Victoria on Friday, October 28th at Camosun College Lansdowne Campus, Fisher 100 at 3100 Fowl Bay Road. Finally, Mr. Hellyer speaks in Vancouver on Tuesday, November 1st on the UBC campus in room Buchanan A201 at 1866 Main Mall. For more details about the tour, visit www.canadianbankreformers.ca/tour. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.